Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting is found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition, for the third week of April 2025, we will be reading an in-depth Esquire feature on America's leading man, Denzel Washington. He's an award-winning actor, director, and producer, pushing 70 years young and still going strong. From there, we will turn to brief bios of Hollywood mavericks, Jesse Eisenberg, Coleman Domingo, and Lisa Joy among them, eager to join Mr. Washington in the pantheon of Hollywood greats. Before we begin, though, I must mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. He has lived a big life. Tough streets, close calls, a wife of 41 years, four kids, 50 movies, two Oscars, three equalizers, all by the grace of God. For the first time, on the occasion of Gladiator II, one of the biggest films of his epic career, and his approaching 70th birthday, the man himself breaks it all down in his own words to the moments that mattered and the experiences that made him. He has lived a big life, but Denzel Washington ain't done yet. The Book of Denzel by Denzel Washington, as told to Ryan DiAgostino. I was with my friend Frank the night his brother murdered a guy. It was Mount Vernon, New York, where I grew up. We were maybe 11, 12. My parents were getting divorced, and me and Frank were out late, just walking around, and we'd stay wherever we ended up for the night. I'm changing the names. This was a long time ago. We ran into his brother, Robert. Now, everybody knew Robert was a guy who, bless him, everybody said was crazy after he came back from Vietnam. They said he's crazy and he's a killer and be careful. I think he was Green Beret, those guys that would cut throats behind enemy lines. But he didn't bother me none. We'd smoke weed together and he'd say, "You know, D, everybody's scared of me, man, but you're not scared of me." And I said, "Well, man, you're just Frank's big brother." I met Frank because when I was 11, I started working in a barbershop up on 4th Avenue. To get there, you had to cut, or I would cut, through the projects where the basketball courts were. So I started meeting a whole new group of friends in there. Everybody was gone for Frank and Robert. Mother, father, nobody around for them. Frank lived with our other friend, Mitch. Miss Mitchell took him in. We had a little band, four of us. Mitch was our lead guitar player. Frank played bass. Our friend Jake played the drums, and I played keyboards. My mother owned her own business, a beauty salon, so we had a little bit more money, and she could buy me an organ, a Farfisa. We used to rehearse over Jake's mother's house, maybe 10 minutes away from my house, down by Memorial Field, because they had an attic three or four floors up where nobody could hear us. None of us read music. We'd sit up there and listen to records and just try to peck out our little part for whatever James Brown song we were trying to play and get your little solo. I wasn't as good with the solos because I didn't know how to play, but Frank could play good solos, and Jake, man, he could go for 20 minutes. We entered a talent show in those same projects one time, and we plugged all our equipment into the outdoor lights. The lights shut off at midnight, so we were the last act, but we won. And I was performing back in middle school, too, or trying to. Me and my friend Wayne Bridges. He's Ludacris's dad, who I met at the boys' club. We did a Beatles song in the talent show back then. And there were older guys in the neighborhood who we wanted to be like. One guy in particular named Donald Fletcher. And me and Wayne would practice his walk. Elements of that walk are still with me today in the movies. I used to practice moving my shoulders while I walked, trying to look like him because he was cool, and I wanted to be cool. You didn't know why exactly at the time. All you knew was that you're 6 and he's 10 and you want to be like him when you grow up. So anyway, me and Frank coming down the street and we see Robert with this guy, Joe, and he tells Joe to go down to the grocery store to get him some Colt 45 malt liquor. Gives him some money. And as Joe takes off down the street, Robert says, real quiet to me and Frank, I'm going to kill him tonight. Just then, Joe turned around from down the street and hollered, could he get 2 bottles? Robert shouted back at him all nice, what? Yeah, get a bottle for yourself, too, and bring me back my change. Then he turned back to us and said, see, he don't know that I know he stole my motorcycle. Joe did steal it and either sold it or crashed it and burned it up or something like that. And I just want him to have a good time on his last night living. And Robert walked off down the street real slow, in and out of the streetlights. I looked at Frank, and he looked at me, eyes real wide, and I whispered to him, man, he wasn't joking. They were both dope fiends, Robert and Joe, and you just don't know. So we ran to my house to get out of there, and then we ran back over there early the next morning in a hurry to find out what happened. Well, when Joe got back with the Colt 45, Robert had stabbed him in the back of the neck. And then he closed the knife up and sat in the middle of the street in the lotus position, waiting for the police. Forget my story, you know. I'm some actor, but Frank, his story? It was my story that night, but it was the story of his life. That was his life. His brother Robert killed Joe, and his other brother was doing time in Leavenworth. No place you want to be. I forget what the other brother did, because sometimes all those boys and all those crimes run together like water, and you can't remember one from the other. Or maybe I don't want to, but when you think back to the big moments in your life, what are they? Was it making a movie, or was it watching Robert walk down that dark street wondering what was going on in his head? Those characters I played in Training Day, in American Gangster. It might look like they were close to me, and I could tell you they were, but I wasn't no gangster. I ran with them real gangsters down there, but I was not them, so let me not tell you a lie. I had 1 foot in the streets, but I ain't no killer. I can't think of a single role where I would say, man, that's me. Entirely me? No. First of all, there are lines that you read and you learn, and that's how that person talks. Sure, there has to be pieces of what you've done in who you are, and hopefully there's pieces of who you are and what you've done. My mother used to say, boy, you've got to smile more, because if you don't, people think you're angry. So I had something in me. But I've never said, King Kong ain't got shit on me in my life. But Alonzo, that character in Training Day, was bigger than King Kong. It was something I said in the spur of the moment, but that's how he felt. He was losing because the whole neighborhood was turning its back on him, so he had to be even bigger than he was. He's got to be King Kong now. So I just said it. I created that character out of lines someone else wrote. I changed pretty much everything. In the original script, he was more of a straight-ahead cop, but we got into the whole gangster side of it and met some gangster cops. We did the research. I was in Mount Vernon not long ago, and I ran into Frank. No kidding. Somebody yelled over to me, yo, D, you know Frank lives right here? Look, I got a picture of the two of us. We're the same age, but it doesn't look like it. Look at that broken body of his. So, who am I compared to that guy? I mean, prison was the only safe place for him. Look at his hands, how they look gnarled. I showed this picture to another guy who did time, and he said, D, that's what 40 years of prison food will do to you. Because that's what Frank did, probably 40 years. Got into armed robbery and all kinds of stuff. I always take care of Frank. He knows when he sees me. I hit him off. He didn't have a chance, man. 2. Prep school in the 70s. Acid. Lot of acid. I said, oh, my God, yeah. I was in a little private semi-military school called Oakland Academy in New Windsor, New York, up by Poughkeepsie. My mother sent me up there because I had tested well in school, but I had one foot in the streets, and I can't remember if I was already selling drugs at that point. Yeah, well, sometimes you do what you're around. I was doing everything Frank and Mitch were doing, throwing rocks at the penitentiary, as they call it. I was throwing rocks at the penitentiary at 13, and I stopped going to school much. So they sat down with my mother, said, look, you need to get him out. Said, I showed potential. There were rich white kids at Oakland, but it was all kinds. There was one famous mafia kid up there. I don't know which family. One of the Columbos. I think it was Colombo. I did all 4 years up there. I was introduced to people from all these other places I'd never been. Fairfield County, all over. I learned about other people's lives and backgrounds and acid. Blotters. Orange Owsley. We did it on Fridays because we had to be back in class Monday. My first trip, the trees are moving. I'm scared to leave. I was by myself, and everyone else was waiting for me back at the little lodges we lived in. And this is probably why I'm screwed up now. I don't think I got back until 4 in the morning, and I'm sneaking around, knocking on everyone's doors, telling them, man, there was the snake, and the spiders were trying to come through, and they started laughing. They said, Dee, you're tripping. I said, I know. It was pretty tame, though. It was psychedelic, but it was tame. There was a little weed around and the acid when someone could get it. I wasn't big on alcohol, partly because you had to sneak out and go get somebody to get it for you in Newburgh on the weekends. Newburgh was 2 miles away, a big town, and it was tough, a depressed place. There was one big wide street, and you had to stand outside while someone got the beer. Not my thing. Until later. 3. The biggest moment of my life was when I was filled with the Holy Spirit. It happened in the West Angels Church of God in Christ, Crenshaw Boulevard, Los Angeles. Let me tell you first that my father was a man of God and a very gentle man, big dude. He worked 3 jobs. He was up at 4 in the morning, so when I went to school, he was already gone. He came home at something in the afternoon, and he had a second job, and then he was a night watchman at S. Klein's department store up in Yonkers, where he probably slept. We didn't have teaching conversations. He taught me only by example. Plus, most of the time, I'm out of the house. I was at Nathan Hale Elementary in Mount Vernon when they started building the boys' club in 1959. I watched the construction every day and wondered, what was going on? And then I find out, a club for boys. I think you had to wait till you were 6 to join, and so as soon as I turned 6, I was just in there. Arts and crafts upstairs. Learn how to make something out of popsicle sticks, or you learn how to play pool and ping pong, or you play baseball and basketball and football. That was me. We never had to worry about eating. Don't get me started with how soft and easy people got it now. At 6, 7, 8 years old, you're trying to get out in the yard, and Dad just worked. And that's what we knew. He worked. His father, my grandfather, was a farmer. Here's a fact. We are descendants of George Washington. We're ex-slaves. My sister did the whole genealogical history of our family. She is truly a genius. She's good, and she spent forever figuring it all out. We still own land down there, not far from D.C. Come on, our last name's Washington. Do the math. My father, though, he was a gentleman, handsome guy, and charismatic, but not educated, no, sir. When it was time to read something, he fiddled. I remember once when my mother wanted to show him something, he pretended to try to find his glasses and then said, oh, never mind. And she said, here, just give it to me. I didn't understand it then, but when I look back, I think he was trying to stall. See, I know he didn't graduate from high school. They were farming. He was born in 1909, and I don't think he was going to kindergarten in 1914 in Dilwyn, Virginia, town of 500 people. After they divorced, my mother was a woman in a man's world trying to make money. She and her business partner owned the beauty shop. That was a big deal then. And then they opened an ice cream shop so that we kids could work there to keep us off the street in the summer. And I got so sick of ice cream. Oh, just the smell of it. But really, I grew up in the boys' club. As I got older, I started carrying my little switchblade, walking down to the club by myself, all swagger. I had a mentor then, Billy Thomas. He's still in my life. He slapped me in the face one time, and I'll tell you what, that was a lesson. Billy's not tall, but I was so little. He was on one knee, and I was standing, and he's telling me something important, and I wasn't listening. I'm looking around like, okay, yeah, okay, because I want to get back out and play with the other kids, and then, pow, pay attention. I never forgot it. And I wasn't about to tell anybody, because, shoot, I knew what my mother was going to say. Well, why'd he hit you? What'd you do? But if I grew up in a boys' club, I also grew up in the church, always in church, and I would see the altar calls as a child, which, to a little boy, just looks like people come up and then they take them into the prayer room. I knew what that was, people being saved, but I didn't really know. So now I'm an adult, 1983, 84, and Robert Townsend and I used to run pretty good together back in those days. You know him. Great actor, great director, directed Hollywood Shuffle, directed Eddie Murphy Raw. Right now, he's on The Bear, playing Sidney's father. He's so good. And we had done the movie, A Soldier's Story. Robert turned me on to West Angels Church. And you have the prayers and everything at the end, and you get up and stand, and then they have that call to the altar, if anyone wants to come and be saved or whatever. Come on up. And you go up now. Now, I had never gone up in my life, but this particular day I said, I'm going up there. And I went up. They said what they say. They took me into a back room somewhere. They prayed for me. Me. I'm thinking, I'm just going to give it up to God today, whatever that means. And I got back there, and they were praying and telling it to us. I'm hallelujah-ing, and I was just feeling it. It felt like I was getting lifted up. It felt like my back was arched, and I had my eyes closed. Not that I was going up in the air, but I can't exactly describe it. And I was blabbering and kept blabbering because I was filled with the Holy Spirit. I could hear the people gathering around me. They had seen this before. I could feel them ministering to me, touching me, talking to me, protecting me. And then, and this is going to sound like I was doing acid again, I came down. I was slobbering and I was crying. I felt embarrassed because I didn't know exactly what had happened. I hadn't experienced it before or even seen it. Growing up, I'd seen members of the church jumping and running up and down the aisles and all of that, but this scared me. It was too powerful. It was too much. It was too much. It was too much. It was unbelievable. It was exhausting. And then the strange thing is, after this thing happens to you and you're all shaken, okay, now what? What do you do with that? You go back to the back of the church and they give you some literature and your wife's waiting for you outside. You get in the car and go have brunch. Things I said about God when I was a little boy, just reciting them in church along with everybody else, I know now. God is real. God is love. God is the only way. God is the true way. God blesses. It is my job to lift God up, to give him praise, to make sure that anyone and everyone I speak to the rest of my life understands that he is responsible for me. When you see me, you see the best I could do with what I've been given by my Lord and Savior. I'm unafraid. I don't care what anyone thinks. See, talking about the fear part of it, you can't talk like that and win Oscars. You can't talk like that and party. You can't say that in this town. Now, I'm free now. It's not talked about in this town. It's not talked about. It's not talked about. It's not fashionable. It's not sexy. But that doesn't mean people in Hollywood don't believe. There's no such thing called Hollywood anyway. What does that even mean? That, to me, means a street called Hollywood Boulevard. It's not like we all meet somewhere and discuss what we believe. So I don't know how many other actors have faith. I didn't do no poll. How would I find that out? I mean, there's no church actor meetings I've been to. I don't have a lot of actor friends. Family friends, sure, like Sam Jackson. His wife and Pauletta go way back, and he and I go all the way back to A Soldier's Play in 1981. But now, when I make a movie, I'm not trying to make friends. We rap. I'm trying to go home. That's not to say that if I see, I don't know, Tom Hanks, it's not great. It is. I love Tom Hanks. I just don't see him. I didn't see him much before Philadelphia either. We're in the same business, but not necessarily the same town at any moment. Just the way it goes. But my faith has always informed the roles I choose. Always. I've always been led by God, and most of my performances are faith-filled. Even if I was playing the devil, I still have my shooting script from Training Day, and I wrote on the cover, "The wages of sin is death. The wages of sin is death." And now, all these years later, in Gladiator 2, I play another bad guy in another great movie, even in the darkest stories. I'm looking for the light.
4. Listen, you're at an awards show with a free tuxedo. You went there in a limousine and they didn't call your name. Oh, this was 2000. 20-something years into my being an actor. I had worked at a camp in Lakeville, Connecticut through the Boys Club, and we did some theater, and I liked that. And when I somehow got into Fordham, got in, flunked out, got in again, that's when it really started, and then I got the play, A Soldier's Play, which became the movie, A Soldier's Story, and then St. Elsewhere and all that and on, and Glory, 1989, and then here I am again at the Oscars. I think I had won the Golden Globe for Hurricane. See, I barely remember now. Ain't that crazy? But then at the Oscars, they called Kevin Spacey's name for American Beauty, and I have a memory of turning around and looking at him, and nobody was standing but the people around him. And everyone else was looking at me. Not that it was this way. Maybe that's the way I perceived it. Maybe I felt like everybody was looking at me, because why would everybody be looking at me? Thinking about it now, I don't think they were. I'm sure I went home and drank that night. I had to. I don't want to sound like, oh, he won my Oscar or anything like that. It wasn't like that. And you know, there was talk in the town about what was going on over there on that side of the street, and that's between him and God. I ain't got nothing to do with that. I pray for him. That's between him and his maker. I went through a time then when Paulette would watch all the Oscar movies. I told her, I don't care about that. Hey, they don't care about me. I don't care. You vote. You watch them. I ain't watching that. I gave up. I got bitter. My pity party. So I'll tell you, for about 15 years, from 1999 to 2014, when I put the beverage down, I was bitter. I don't even know offhand what movies I made then. I guess John Q, Manchurian Candidate, but I didn't know I was bitter. Wine is very tricky. It's very slow. It ain't like boom, all of a sudden. And part of it was, we built this big house in 1999 with a 10,000-bottle wine cellar. And I learned to drink the best. So I'm going to drink my 61s and my 82s and whatever we had.
Wine was my thing, and now I was popping $4,000 bottles just because that's what was left. And then later, in those years, I'd call Gil Turner's Fine Wines and Spirits on Sunset Boulevard and say, "Send me 2 bottles, the best of this or that." And my wife saying, "Why do you keep ordering just 2? And I said, "Because if I order more, I'll drink more." So I kept it to 2 bottles, and I would drink them both over the course of the day. I never drank while I was working or preparing. I would clean up, go back to work. I could do both. However, many months of shooting, bang, it's time to go. Then, boom, 3 months of wine. Then, time to go back to work. I'm sure at first it was easy because I was younger. 2 months off and let's go. But drinking was a 15-year pattern. And truth be told, it didn't start in 1999. It started earlier. In fact, it probably has more to do with Frank and those guys. It probably started then. Well, to be honest, that is where it started. I never got strung out on heroin, never got strung out on coke, never got strung out on hard drugs. I shot dope just like they shot dope, but I never got strung out. And I never got strung out on liquor. I had this ideal idea of wine tastings and all that, which is what it was at first, and that's a very subtle thing. I mean, I drank the best. I drank the best, and 15 years into it, send me 2 bottles and make it good stuff, but just 2, and I'd drink them both over the course of the day. I wasn't drinking when we filmed Flight. I know that, but I'm sure I did as soon as I finished. And that was getting toward the end of the drinking, but I knew a lot about waking up and looking around, not knowing what happened. But look, I was put on this planet to do good. I've been blessed with this ability to act, and I've tried to use it for goodness's sake. For goodness's sake, even the darkest guys. I know during Flight, I was thinking about those who had been through addiction, and I wanted good to come out of that. It wasn't like it was therapeutic. Actually, maybe it was therapeutic. It had to have been. But look, I've had so many journeys, so many different kinds of people to play, and even the heroes. I'm not them. I'm not Stephen Biko. I played Stephen Biko. I'm not Malcolm X. People talk to me like I'm Malcolm X to this day. I'm not Malcolm X. I could not stand up to the pressure that he was under. But I've been blessed with the ability to interpret what that does, be it a leader of the Nation of Islam or a fallen down alcoholic. And we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to Denzel. I've done a lot of damage to the body. We'll see. I've been clean. Been 10 years this December. I stopped at 60, and I haven't had a thimble's worth since. Things are opening up for me now, like being 70. It's real, and it's okay. This is the last chapter. If I get another 30, what do I want to do? My mother made it to 97. I'm doing the best I can. And not only alcohol, forget all that, strength. About 2 years ago, my good friend, my little brother, Lenny Kravitz, said, "D, I want to hook you up with a trainer." And he did. And he's another man of God. I started with him February last year. He makes the meals for me, and we're training. And I'm now 190-something pounds on my way to 185. I was looking at pictures of myself and Pauletta at the Academy Awards for Macbeth, and I'm just looking fat with this dyed hair. And I said, "Those days are over, man. I feel like I'm getting strong. Strong is important." 5. 7 a.m., September 23rd, 2023. I was on a yacht in the middle of the Mediterranean off of Italy somewhere. The boat wasn't moving. I was listening to a song alone, just me. I had my Bible, and I had finished reading my prayers in the Daily Word, my morning ritual, and I had music playing through my phone. A song came on called "The Face of God." It was not a song I have in my rotation, and I don't know how it ended up on my phone. The woman was singing about the actual face of God. I said out loud, "You know, Lord, everybody says they've seen your face. They sing about it. They say they saw your face, and I want to see your face. I've never seen..." While I was saying it, I heard, "Look to your left." I mean, I heard it, not thought it, heard the words. There was no one else around. "Look to your left." I looked to my left, off the side of the boat. In the clouds above the ocean, I saw a face, a detailed, proportionate face that took up the whole sky. Eyes, nose. It even had lips and teeth and a little smirk. I grabbed my phone and took this photo. Remember, it was while I was asking, "Lord, everybody gets to see your face and never see. I would like to look to your left." I don't care how you slice it. You can say, "Oh, that's just coincidence." To which I say, "Well, I'm listening to the song. I said, I want to see your face. I heard, look to your left, and that's what I saw." Whatever makes you feel good, I don't care. I know what makes me feel good. I know what I saw. I know what I see. There's no guarantees that your children will see you tonight. There is so much to be thankful for, grateful for, humbled by. What bad does God do? I ask, what good does God do? We don't know. Same God that does earthquakes and hurricanes and cancer brings the sun up in the morning too. We don't know. I'm just grateful and thankful for each God-given day, for the sunrise and the sunset. We don't even know why we wake up in the morning. First thing I do is pray every morning. I read my Bible. I read my daily word every day. I get in my half an hour of quiet time. I'm trying to wake up now and sit there first, put my feet on the floor and sit and be quiet. It's hard. It's easy to get up and do this and that, or you left the idiot box on and that sucks you in. Turn it off. Sit. Then you can start listening. There you go. Birds, be still. Just try to be still. What is that saying? Life's simple pleasures are the best. Fresh air, some water, sounds, just being up another morning, just being. There's no guarantees. That's why we call it faith. Religion is a tricky word because that gets into my religion, your religion, and all that. But faith doesn't sound like it belongs to someone. Anyone can have it. 6. The most recent big moment in my life was more than big, and it was more than a moment, and it had nothing to do with me. On one hand, this moment was a culmination of all of Pauletta's work raising our children, and of my work, and of their work becoming these people that they are. And then on the other hand, this moment I'm talking about was just the beginning. Backing up a second, if you don't know who August Wilson was, the playwright, think about Arthur Miller. Think about Tennessee Williams, Edward Albee, Eugene O'Neill. That's where Wilson's work lives, in that pantheon. He wrote 10 plays, each one set in a different decade of the 20th century, telling his view of what it was like to be black in America at that time. All but one are set in Pittsburgh. August died in 2005, God bless him, too young. He was 60. And then a few years ago, his widow, Costanza Romero, and the estate asked if I would produce a movie of each play. I said, "You got the right man for the job." I don't mean because I'm so great. I mean because I see it as a privilege to be asked to bring one of our great playwrights to life in film. I mean, come on, I'll take that. It's a privilege. He doesn't owe me a thing. To be able to shepherd and, in a small way, be a part of it, because I'm really just
handing each one over to the next director, and then I don't go hovering all over them. You have to trust. You can't ask someone to direct a film and then look over their shoulder every 2 seconds. And in this case in particular, the material's the material. August wrote it. It's like they say, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage, and his genius is on the page. We've done 3 of them now. Fences, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and now The Piano Lesson. My son Malcolm directed it. My son John David is in it. My daughter Katya produced it. We went to the Toronto International Film Festival with it earlier this year, and that was a moment. Sitting on that stage after the screening for the question and answer session with 3 of my children, Lord! Their mother was in the audience. It was a gorgeous theater, one of the older ones in Toronto, which was appropriate for this film. Maybe 1,500 people there, full house. And they had chairs set up for us. Malcolm, then John David next to him, the incredible other cast members, Danielle Deadwyler, Ray Fisher and Michael Potts, Katya, my producing partner, Todd Black, and me, way down the end, trying not to get noticed. I've done a lot of Q&A sessions at film festivals, but this one, it doesn't get better than that. When it was time to leave the stage, I waved everyone past me, one by one, waiting for Malcolm so I could give him a hug and walk off together, my hand on his shoulder. I was still producing. Everyone march off, then me and him close it out. Still in charge, still Dad. Malcolm used to beat everybody in Monopoly. They wouldn't play him. He walked around with a Monopoly set, and John David wouldn't ever play because Malcolm would always want to be the bank. Nobody could beat him or even wanted to beat him. And that's Malcolm. In high school, he recruited a couple of basketball players to make the team better, and they won the state championship on his division level. He was the point guard. That's Malcolm. He has the ball in his hands, and he puts the team together. I don't see myself acting in any of the remaining 7 Wilson films. I did Fences. For one thing, I don't see a role, but also I have things lined up for a few years. I told them I would do another Equalizer, and we're doing 4 and 5. More people are happy about that. People love those daggone Equalizers. It's about variety for me. I'll sometimes say to myself, one's for me, one's for them. So, for example, Othello. We're doing it on Broadway and then a movie. That's for me. But I've come to realize that the Equalizer films are for me, too, because they're for the people. They want me to go get the bad guys. We can't get them, so you go get them. And I say, okay, I'll get them. Just wait right there. I'll be right back. But that's also what I love about Gladiator, too. It ain't just about me. It's a great cast and a great story, and I get to be a part of it. I love the first one with my friend Russell Crowe. When Ridley Scott called asking if I would be in it, are you kidding? It took me about 2 seconds to say yes. We had done American Gangster, of course, also with Russell. But this film, Gladiator 2, continues a great epic story in such a truthful way, an exciting way. It's a wonderful script, and I'm happy I'm in it. With those fantastic actors. And Piano Lesson? Shoot, it definitely ain't about me. That moment up on stage in Toronto wasn't about me. Our children pulled it off. They did it. Even when we were shooting, I'm supposed to be one of the producers, and I'm also their dad, but about 2 weeks in, I went home. Nothing really for me to do. You know when you say something to the group and they give you a polite answer like, yeah, thanks, we're a little busy here, thanks for the... Okay, so where were we? Even at the party after the screening and the Q&A, Pauletta and I were in the corner just hanging out, watching Malcolm and John David and Katya just float around that room, just soaring. I was there as best I could be for my children. I'd fly in from whatever movie I was doing and be with them. I remember when Pauletta was pregnant with Katya around 1987. I was filming for Queen and Country in London. I scheduled 5 days off before the due date and 5 days after, and I flew home for that. That was my version of commuting. We were always coming back together, but then that's it. Daddy's
got to go do his thing, go to Indianapolis for 4 months or whatever, and you've got to go to school. You get the grades. I go do what I got to do. That's how it goes around here. There's no easy way. We taught them the old-fashioned, hard-work way. Pauletta read a chapter from the Bible to them every day at breakfast, and they would have discussions about it. She laid the foundation while I was out killing the whatever it is, killing the animal and bringing home the meat. The bacon. But that alone. All four of them, healthy and in their right mind, enough said. Pauletta did a brilliant job with them. She taught them the right way. I came along for the ride. I taught by example, good and bad. Yes, sir, good and bad. You think of the million other ways things could have gone. Mitch did 20, 25 years. He died of AIDS. Frank probably did 40 years. Jake died. That was our band, the four of us, and by the grace of God, I didn't do a day. I love what I do, and I'm fortunate that I have this ability to act, and I don't want to make light of it, but it's just acting, man. It ain't rocket science. I don't mark the big moments of my life by the movies I made. My mother said, man gives the award, God gives the reward. So one of them Oscars I won? And that's the trippy part, isn't it? How easily that rolls off the tongue. I said, one of them Oscars, man. But no, when I think of what I'm proudest of, anything I've accomplished doesn't even come to mind. It's our children. They're good people. They know right from wrong. What else can you ask for, you know? And that concludes the Book of Denzel. And now we're on to the Mavericks of Hollywood. A creative rebellion is crackling through Tinseltown. Yes, AI looms. The algorithm pushes us toward the same dull programs, and the way we consume our movies and TV has never been more fragmented. But that's precisely why we are craving, demanding really, art that feels authentic. We want bold and daring entertainment, storytelling that surprises us, propelled by characters who ring true. After more than a decade of Marvel totality, Hollywood is finally answering this call. The spirit that thrived in Hollywood in the 70s and again in the 90s has returned, and these 10 men and women embody the movement. They possess bold creative vision, unique talent, and a fearlessness that is undeniably real. Jesse Eisenberg, 40, actor, writer, and director. Jesse Eisenberg pays attention especially to his own words. He'll begin to answer a question and then pause, editing in real time, and start over because he doesn't want to sound pretentious or incompetent. For decades, he's paid close attention on movie sets, figuring out the way I like to work and figuring out what doesn't work. And now he's drawing on that experience as a director, a turn he never expected. Even 5 years ago, I would have said, I don't want to direct a movie, he says. That just seems ridiculous and aspirational and impossible. Eisenberg first came to our attention acting in indie films like The Squid and the Whale in 2005, before his star turn as Mark Zuckerberg in The Social Network in 2010. He's done big-budget franchises, Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, and prestige TV. Fleischman is in trouble. But he eschews the traditional Hollywood path. He lives in New York rather than L.A., and he increasingly pours his creative energy into writing, everything from humor pieces in McSweeney's and The New Yorker to four stage plays to his second feature film, A Real Pain, which Eisenberg directed and co-stars in with Kieran Culkin. The two play estranged cousins on a Holocaust tour in Poland. Working with Culkin on the movie, which comes out in October, was another step in his ongoing education. I really don't like improv, but Kieran is such an unusual performer, he says. He would say things that deviated from the script, and a lot of times they were just better. Well aware of the vagaries of his profession, Eisenberg recognizes a good streak when he's on one. After spending the summer shooting Now You See Me 3 as an actor, he'll begin filming his third feature as a writer-director this fall.
"My only goal in the arts is to stay busy," he says.
There's little chance of him slowing down anytime soon, so make sure you pay attention. Coleman Domingo, 54, actor, writer, and producer. If it feels like Coleman Domingo is suddenly everywhere, that's only half right. "I've always been a playwright and a director," he says, in a quiet spot amid construction in the Malibu home he's building. "I came up as a guy who can act and sing and dance and produce and write. I write musicals, plays, television, film, and I produce. I've always been working." The path to everywhere has always been uniquely his. "I'll say this with no ego. I hadn't seen a lot of people do things the way I do." He is, to our knowledge, the only Best Actor Academy Award nominee to have been in the cast of Logo's Big Gay Sketch Show. If anyone else has acted for Spike Lee, Steven Spielberg, and Ava DuVernay and co-written the book for Broadway's Summer, the Donna Summer musical, we are not aware of them. There was no blueprint for this career. The Oscar buzz from last year's Rustin had barely died down before a new one began for this year's Sing Sing, a film based on the real-life rehabilitation through the arts program, which uses theater to instill life skills in incarcerated people. Domingo stars as actual former RTA participant John Divine G. Whitfield, alongside a cast of RTA alumni. True to his nature, Domingo and his co-producers developed an innovative profit-sharing program for the film. "We made sure that everyone has equity above and below the line. We said, when we sell the film, everyone is looked after." Domingo admits that his star has risen. "It feels like a new level of busy for me," he says, "but it's just noisier for others because now they can see it. And the splintering of the entertainment industry favors polymaths like Domingo. I was never relying on being cast or being invited to play at someone's table," he says. "I was too busy building my own house." Now he's building one in Malibu. Hiroyuki Sanada, 63, actor and producer. Hiroyuki Sanada speaks in poetry as we share a battle of rosé with the setting sun. He takes a moment to outline his dream in vivid, inspirational language. 20 years ago, my hope was to break the wall between East and West and make a bridge," says Sanada. "In these last few years, the wall has cracked. There's a space to walk, and Shogun has made it wider." Sanada said something very similar to me just a year ago when he starred in John Wick, Chapter 4, alongside Keanu Reeves. Back then, no one could have predicted that a Japanese samurai drama on FX called Shogun would be such a critical and ratings hit. The show has earned praise for everything from its costumes and set design to the bold move of having roughly 70% of its dialogue be in Japanese with subtitles. FX asked Sanada, whose long list of credits includes HBO's Westworld, The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise, and dozens of Japanese film and TV projects, to both star and serve as a producer. He took on the responsibility because he felt it was necessary to make an authentic drama. Sanada recently agreed to extend the show, intended as a one-off miniseries, for 2 more seasons. "As an actor, I never thought about season 2, he says. "But as a producer, it's not about me. I have to keep this platform for the Japanese cast and crew and for the talent to tell Japanese stories. I cannot say no. I thought, let's give more chances for the next generation." With Shogun's success, Sanada is now one step closer to his dream of bridging East and West. Still, he remains humble. As the sun sets and our glasses empty, he leaves me with one more turn of phrase. "If we've made a wooden bridge, maybe in the future it will be asphalt." Sanada says with a hearty laugh, "That's my mission. And maybe one more glass of rosé." Coralie Fargeet, 48 director and writer. As a child growing up in Paris, Coralie Farragut never felt fully adapted to the real world. Extremely shy, she wasn't very interested in playing with dolls or the other regular stuff that little girls were supposed to like. She did everything she could to escape reality, and she spent a lot of time with her grandfather, a free spirit and cinephile who introduced her to everything from Chaplin to Rambo. Farragut became movie-obsessed. As a teen, she appropriated the family video camera to make her own short film version of Star Wars for an amateur contest. She was immediately hooked. "That was really the shift for me," she says. "I was a totally different person. I felt super powerful, like no one can stop me." Farragut has followed that feeling of liberation and her own artistic vision as a filmmaker ever since, even when it often seemed like no one else got it. A few decades later, she's finally breaking through. Her second feature film, The Substance, won Best Screenplay at Cannes back in May and stirred up plenty of Oscar chatter for Demi Moore's all-in performance. The body horror thriller, which Farragut wrote, directed, and co-edited, in which co-stars Margaret Qualley and Dennis Quaid, is a biting commentary on sexism and ageism, especially in the entertainment industry. It's a potent mix of dark humor and gross-out shock with elements of Kubrick and Cronenberg. The enthusiastic reviews for The Substance are powerful validation for Farragut. For years, she wrote science fiction scripts only for her ideas to be rejected by French producers. "For real, everybody was looking at me like an alien," she says. At last, she is able to share her full filmmaking vision with audiences. "This movie has really kind of made me stronger," says Farragut, "because I know being a director is what I'm made for. It's who I am, and who she always was." Lisa Joy, 47, writer, producer, and director. And Jonathan Nolan, 48, writer, producer, and director. "I'm taking an intellectual detour," says Lisa Joy, after we discuss digital protection laws and the new Princess Peach game. "But before we go deep on German nationalism, I'm at the West Village apartment of Joy and Jonathan Nolan, the husband-wife duo behind Westworld, The Peripheral, and Fallout." Nolan also co-wrote Interstellar and two of the Christian Bale-led Batman films with his brother Chris. "I also might sound like a lunatic," she warns. Nolan quips, "Our work's been out there for a while. People know." Here's the thing. My entire 90-minute conversation with Joy and Nolan is an intellectual detour, and that's exactly why they're two of the most original storytellers in Hollywood right now. They dare to take on the big subjects. This particular curveball, our very notion of what a genius looks like, has been shaped by the people in the power to define it and then anoint themselves geniuses. Nolan and Joy's brainy, weirdo, existentialist superpowers are on a full display in Prime Video's Fallout, which tasked them with overcoming the notoriously insurmountable video game adaptation curse. They spun the long-running franchise, which imagines an alternate reality where nuclear annihilation goes down after World War II, into a surprisingly hilarious sci-fi road trip. Season 2, per Nolan, will go deeper, darker into all the nooks and crannies where the games go. Nolan and Joy light up when we start talking about the Emmy-winning Westworld, which they co-created for 4 seasons on HBO before it was canceled in 2022. They're not exactly looking for a new home for the series, but they've clearly put a lot of thought into Season 5. "We always had a plan on where to go with it," says Joy. As for what worlds the pair will create next, they're cagey about details. Joy is dabbling in writing a horror movie, and Nolan says he wants to make a space opera. So let's explore a more mundane topic. What's it like working with the person you're married to? "I feel like killing him," Joy says, laughing. "No, I feel like no one is harder on me," she adds, and vice versa. No intellectual shortcuts allowed. Anthony Ramos, 32, actor. "Damn, what are you getting here, bro?" asks Anthony Ramos. He peers at me over his menu, baseball cap pulled low. We're at the West Village's Corner Bistro, a New York City institution that neither of us has been to before. I tell him that I've heard, no promises, that the burgers are good. "I'm going to get a bistro mini," says Ramos. "That's probably a mini burger, right?" There's plenty to talk about while we wait for the food because the actor, singer, dancer has roughly 100 things going on. You first met the Brooklyn-raised Ramos in the original cast of Hamilton, in which he starred as both John Lawrence and Philip Hamilton. When Ramos left Hamilton in 2016, he quickly proved that he quite simply can do everything. He's the rare young actor who can pull off franchise fare with just as much authenticity as his passion projects. The highlight reel includes leading roles in Transformers, Rise of the Beasts, In the Heights, and this past summer, Twisters. What's next? Marvel. In 2025, Ramos will star as the villain on Ironheart, a Disney Plus series following the quasi-successor to Iron Man. "I'll show you some shit," Ramos quips, pulling up his phone and showing me so many pics of his character, known as the Hood, that I'm nearly certain Kevin Feige will detonate Corner Bistro on the spot. "He's from Humboldt Park, which is like a little Puerto Rico in Chicago," says Ramos, who is of Puerto Rican descent himself. "I love this shit." He's also writing a musical about the nativity story. Ramos hunches over, eats about a third of his bistro mini in one bite, and flashes an ear-to-ear smile. "Damn, this burger's fucking good." The man is hungry. Yep, the drummer's drumming, and that means another hour has flown past here on Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and I have enjoyed reading the Book of Denzel for you, followed by profiles of some of the up-and-comers that are nipping at his heels. I hope you enjoyed these stories. I know I did. Particularly Denzel's description of how he gets up and gets moving in the morning. Starts with quiet and peace rather than phones and screens and TV sets. Something to chew on there. Between now and next week, may you find some peace, have some good slumbers, and some fine mornings. Peace.